Thank you, Glenn, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. That's better. First of all, I want to acknowledge the debt of gratitude, which I shall never be able to pay, to the Papa Texas Group and to the Roundup Committee for affording me the privilege of attending this wonderful conference. This has been a high spot indeed in my AA life, probably only exceeded by our experience in St. Louis last year. Seems to me that everything about this particular roundup has topped the top of Texas. And it seems that Austin and I have a very easy job this morning because all we have to do is just try to keep from lousing this thing up. It's already done. We've already had it. I think conferences are a wonderful thing. Certainly, they take us to the height of inspiration. And I shall never forget how I felt yesterday morning after our beloved Bill Mundy had sat down. I thought the very best thing I could do was to get the hell out of here and go home. I figured that anything after that was sending a boy to do a man's job. And it wasn't until about 4:30 yesterday afternoon when I had gone up and attempted to relax a little that I came back to your party. I was lying up there on my bed and I thought of rule number 62 in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now maybe you all have been told that there are no rules or regulations that there are. And rule number 62 is wonderful. Rule number 62 says, don't take yourself to goddamn seriously. And so when I thought of rule 62, I came back, and I've been having a wonderful time ever since. Now, inspiration is a wonderful thing. We can get inspiration from listening to a wonderful talk, like the talk we've had, from reading good books, from listening to good sermons, and from prayer and meditation. But the longer I am privileged to live in this great fellowship of ours, the more I see that there is nothing on the face of the earth that will take the place of the practice of these principles in all of our affairs. You know, we're liable to come to a meeting of this kind, to a conference of this kind, and get on Cloud 99 and be due for a big letdown when we get home. I'm mindful of a chap who had 1 year of sobriety after a great deal of pain and anguish over several years trying to get that first case. And his good wife, in celebration of his 1 year, bought him an airplane ticket to St. Louis last year. And he was riding the same plane with me. And oh, he was really up there. And we got back to St. Louis and he met all the great men and listened to the great talk. And it was too much for him and he got drunk. And he was a pretty sorry sight on the plane going back home. Of course, he lost his seniority and had to start over. And so, it would be my duty this morning, I think, to remind us all that life is so big. Life is so big. And yesterday's practice of these principles ensured yesterday's sobriety. But today's practice of the principles ensures today's sobriety. Life is so big. And certainly, if we are to enjoy this wonderful AA way of life, we must see that action is the magic word. Perhaps for the old as well as the new, it is well for us to remember that since this wonderful thing was given to us by or through drunks that didn't have to drink anymore, that the only right we have to keep it is to give it to drunks who still don't know. And I think that the very minute we forget that we are channels for this wonderful thing, and we stop giving it away, we stop growing. And a very happy sobriety can turn into a drunk when we quit walking upstairs. I'm very mindful of a little letter that Mrs. Chamberlain and I received maybe a couple of years back. That was such a great reminder to me of what Alcoholics Anonymous is and why it is. This letter came from the North, and it started this way. It says, "Jeff, you weren't here last night, but you were. And I have to tell you about this meeting and share it with you." Because we had a participation meeting. And this is the first chap that got up was a little Mexican. And he said that he had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for some 4 years, and he couldn't find what he had to have, so he got drunk. And he ended up in Norwalk State Hospital for the insane. And he says one Sunday morning there was an old boy by the name of Chuck Chamberlain came down there, and he said so-and-so, and he gave the quote. And it was my key. And I went out into the ground, and I found myself. And I've had a very happy experience ever since. And the next guy got up, and he says, "That's funny, I heard him in Hanford," and he said so-and-so, and he gave the quote. And it was my key. And the next guy got up, he says, "That's funny, I heard him in Vallejo," and he said so-and-so, and that was my key. And so it was that everybody that got up in the meeting said the same thing. And here were all these quotations. And she ended up by saying, "And you know, my key was your interpretation of the prodigal son story. And so you see, you weren't here, but you were." And it was so beautiful that Mrs. T and I sat there and read it and bawled. We just cried, you know. And then I read it again, and I started laughing. And Mrs. T says, "What now?" And I said, "Listen to these quotes." And there wasn't a damn one of them. It was mine, you know, not one. Oh, terrific. You see, I'd stolen them all from somebody else. And so it is that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just you helping me and the two of us by the grace of God helping somebody else. That's what this great fellowship is. Just the people helping the people with the grace of God. Terrific thing. And of course, when we sit here and hear members of the cloth and members of the medical profession and the law enforcement agencies telling us how wonderful we are, we have a great and welling sense of pride of this fellowship within us. But again, we are reminded that our only business is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still does. This is the only business we are in, and the only reason that these great men have the opinion of us that they do is because so far we have carried the message successfully to the alcoholic who still does. And we must never forget that the only way that we can merit and retain this high regard is that we continue to carry this message successfully to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, with those two preliminaries, I'm going to have some fun. I don't know whether you are or not. I'm just going to try to tell you a little bit of what this thing means to me. I'm not going to tell you my story, because I made the mistake of going with Bill and his chief of police to the meeting on Friday night, and he stole my story verbatim, got up here and told it better than I could yesterday. So there's no sense to be fooling with it. But I would like to try to tell you a little of what it means to me, this fellowship of ours. First place, I can't even take the credit for coming to my first meeting. There is no credit due me in this new deal at all. I am just as sure that I stand here that I would never have lived to attend my first meeting if it hadn't have been for the prayers of a few non-alcoholics who still were hoping that something might happen to them. And so it was that I didn't want to come here. I knew about this society 5 years before I came crawling in. But I didn't want to come here. This is the last place I ever wanted to come. It was inconceivable to me that I could find any value in associating myself with a bunch of drunks that couldn't handle the liquor. And I was a naturally bright boy. I think all alcoholics are naturally bright. And when you're naturally bright, it takes a little longer, you know. You don't learn very easy. And so it was that I had to completely run out of rope before I would come here at all. And I can't even take the credit for coming to the first meeting. I had to come. There wasn't any place else to go. And of course, I can't take credit for anything that's happened since I got here. There's only one thing in my life that I can take credit for. I had 43 years to run my life, doing my own thinking and my own planning. During those 43 years, I was the master of ceremonies and the star of the show. And at the end of 43 years, I not only was a failure as a drunk, but I was a failure as a husband, a failure as a father, a failure as a businessman, a failure as a man, and a failure as a drunk at 43. Now this I take credit for. That was all my doing. But what has happened in the last 11 years is not my doing at all, but with the grace of God. What is our problem? Why is it that we can't get along like other people in this world of ours? Why can't we drink liquor like a lot of other people? They tell us that there's 67 million people in the country that drink. And there are only 5 or 6 million of us that can't drink. Why can't we? What is our problem anyway? And that reminds me of a little story. A story that many of you have heard the author tell. He's a Texan. Big old long boy. I believe the first guy that got sober in the state of, city of Houston. In Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says that if you have a problem and want to solve it, it helps if you know what the problem is. He says that helps a good deal. Now, he says, for instance, I've always been afraid of dogs. He says, all my life I've been afraid of dogs. And the old boy is 6 feet 4 inches high. And I can just see him running from a little old poodle, you know, because he says that he can see some little old girl walking down the street leading the Great Dane, and she's not afraid of a dog. But then a little poodle comes out, and he runs. He's just afraid of dogs. And he says some time back, he decided that he ought to find out why it was he was afraid of dogs. So he started looking back through his life. And he got way back to where he was 7 years old, and he remembered that when he was 7, he was bitten by dogs. And so that was probably the reason that he was afraid of. But he said that didn't satisfy him, so he looked at the deal there when he got bitten, and he said the reason that dog bit him was because he was chasing a little girl at the time. Now he says, all my life I've been chasing women and getting into trouble and running from dogs, and dogs never were my problem in the first place. So I reckon it does do a little good if you know what the problem is. Well, our problem is that we are alcoholics. What is an alcoholic? The man or woman who suffers from the disease of alcoholism. And what is the disease of alcoholism? It's a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. This probably is the best definition that you and I will ever hear, and it was given to us by the late Dr. Silkworth. Bill's doctor, both before and after his recovery. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Now this obsession of the mind condemns me to drink, and the allergy of the body condemns me to die if I drink. That is the nature of our problem. An obsession or obsessions of the mind that condemn me to drink, and an allergy of the body that condemns me to die if I drink. Now, this is a pretty rough thing. It is about the third worst killer in the United States today. I believe now topped only by heart and cancer as a killer. And it's topped by one of our social diseases only as a cause for insanity. And medically speaking, this disease is incurable. So that is our problem. It's pretty rough. And since it is both of a physical and mental nature, it becomes a living problem. The problem of alcoholism is not a body. That is our immediate problem, yes. That's the thing we have to get away from far enough that we can get our thinking apparatus to working. But that is only the immediate problem, the bottle itself. Our all-time problem is the problem of the mind, the mental part of this thing. It was a long time after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to see that I was not an alcoholic because I drank too much liquor over too long a period, too often. I used to get up and say that's the reason I was an alcoholic. For a long time, I said that. But after a long time, I saw that I drank too much liquor over too long a period of time, too often, because I was an alcoholic. Because I was an alcoholic. You see, the funny part of this illness of ours is that the first drink is not of a physical causation. The second drink and the 442nd drink are physical. But the first drink is mental. And this is the thing we so often forget. Many amongst us say, well, I came here for sobriety, physical sobriety. I've got it, period. That's it. You see? And many times, physical sobriety being new is sufficient for quite a while, maybe a number of months, or maybe a number of years. But sooner or later, if we haven't taken care of that mental department, life hands us a problem that we can't solve, and we immediately resort to the body. The physical part of the disease to me is very interesting. Number one, that this allergy of the body don't hurt, don't bother me a bit, and won't, unless and until I take of that first blood of life. I haven't had a drink for almost 11 years, and I don't hurt any place this morning. I don't itch. There's nothing wrong with it at all. I feel probably good. But it was just one drink. It sets up a physical craving that will not be denied, and I have to keep pouring that stuff down. Keep pouring it down till the money's gone, the bottle's gone, the wife's gone, the car's gone, everything is gone. But again, the allergy don't hurt until I give it some liquor. Secondly, that this allergy gets worse all the time. The physical part gets worse all the time. Even during long, extended periods of total abstinence, we get less and less able to react normally to alcohol. Now, this is rather difficult for many of us to believe, and many amongst us decide that it ain't true and go out and do a little research. We had an old boy whom you might have down here some of these days that was in this fellowship with us, came in the same time I did, for 5 years, and he did a wonderful job. But he figured that he knew enough now. And he went back to social drinking. And he had us all scared to death, believe me. Because for 2 years he got by with it. And here we were sitting around waiting for him to collapse, and he don't collapse! And we thought it was just the exception that proves the rule. But it got him. And it was 3 years of the worst hell you ever saw before he got back in the program. This is something we must never forget. Although it has been almost 11 years since I had a drink, today I'm 11 years worse off, so far as successfully drinking liquor is concerned, than I was when I came here. Now I believe this because I get around, and I have talked with too many who did my research for me. Thank God. I believe it. I don't want ever to forget it. And lastly, this thing isn't cured. The physical part. So, since there is no answer here or any place else for the physical part of the disease, we turn immediately after recognizing that we have it. We turn immediately to the other part, to the other half of this disease, which is the obsession of the mind that causes us to take that first drink. Now one would think that anyone who had had a lot of trouble with liquor, and particularly a periodic, would during some of his periods of dryness take a look at himself and decide that that flip was no good. You know, being naturally bright. It seems like we could do that. You know. And when I'm talking about having trouble, I mean having trouble. I guess there might be depth to the flu of despond known as alcoholism, which I have not plumbed. But if there are, I pray God that I don't have to. Because the series went something like this with me. I drank successfully, or reasonably so, for about 15 years. And then I didn't drink successfully anymore, but I kept trying for another 10. And your pattern runs about like this, I think, with most of us. I first started having a little trouble. It was home. My good wife didn't... Well, she frowned a little on my... But I reminded her of what a great man I was. I told her what all I was doing for her and the children. And that I only had this one little bite. And it was my head that was hurting, and it wasn't hers. And that I wasn't doing anybody any harm but myself. If I wanted my head to hurt, that was my business. I used to remind her of all the things that I didn't do. And one of them, I would tell her, I'd tell her, I don't run around with other women, I'd say. You know? I just drink. Well, the trouble at home got worse, and trouble with the law started. The time came when I was being detained without my permission. You know? And a little later on, the trouble was blackout. And I didn't know where I was or what I'd done. And a little later on, trouble with music. The banjos would be playing and there wouldn't be no banjo playing around at all. And a little later on, I was meeting the people and talking to them, and they were talking to me, and they weren't there. That's not so bad. It's sort of cozy, you know, to have somebody talk to. Because a little later on, it's the voices and no people. And you're talking to these voices hanging 6-10 feet out in the air, and you know there's nobody up there. But you can't keep from talking to them. And a little later on, you're falling on the floor on your face and chewing your tongue full of holes and babbling like an idiot. And a little later on, you fall on the floor and you don't babble and you don't chew your tongue. You turn blue. And the oxygen squad has to come down and wake you up. Now, this is just about the series that all of us go through if we keep fighting the bottom. And all of these things happened to me many times, but the last one. The last one only happened once, but I even got drunk after that. Now you would think that anyone could look at a series of that kind and say, no, that bottle's not for me. Why can't we do it? Because we are no longer in the position of choice. The obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. And it's just as foolish for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a TB to decide to quit coughing. Quit coughing. If a TB is going to quit coughing, he's got to get rid of TB, the cause. And if you and I, being alcoholics, are going to quit drinking, we've got to get rid of the cause. And that is the insanity that we so politely term obsessions of the mind. This is insanity. Many amongst us don't like that word, but I love it. If I didn't like the word insanity, I wouldn't be here this morning because I wouldn't have the nerve to come down. If I thought that I had done the things I did when I was perfectly sane, I wouldn't show my face any place. So I like the word and have liked it from the beginning. I knew I was nuts when I came here. This insanity, I reckon, is more like kleptomania than anything else. You know, you can have a kleptomaniac and an alcoholic in the same jail. And they can be released at the same time. And the alky will go down one side of the street and he'll pass a bar and he'll say to himself, uh-oh, gotta make a phone call. And he goes in to make a phone call and he comes out 3 hours and a half later and the cops have got him and he's back in jail. And the klepto goes down the other side of the street and he passed the drugstore and he says, uh-oh, I gotta have a package of cigarettes. So he goes into the drugstore and gets a package of cigarettes. And on the way out, he steals a corkscrew. Now, he don't even want a corkscrew. He's not an alcoholic. But there it lays, and it seems like nobody's looking, and he just steals it. He has a compulsion to steal. And so he picks it up, and they see him, and he's back to the same jail, too. It's insanity. I have a lot of fun with this word insanity. I was out at Lincoln Heights Jail. I wouldn't be surprised if we have quite a number of alumni of Lincoln Heights in this audience. I meet alumni all over the United States and Canada from Lincoln Heights. And I was down there and I started talking about insanity and pretty soon they were all looking out the window. There were about 200 men. Sitting out there, and it got funny to me because they weren't insane, you know. And so I said, you monkeys think you're not insane, I know. I said, the only thing you got in your mind is getting out of here. I've been here, I know what you're thinking about. Half of you are trying to get me to spring you before I get out the front door. You want out. Now I said, if you're so clever, and if you're not insane at all, why are you back here? You were here 2 weeks ago and then out. Why'd you come back if you're so sane? Yeah. They came back because they had to, you see. The insanity that allows us to say to ourselves, this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. Now I've analyzed my last group. I know exactly where I made my mistake. All my trouble started after Tuesday. If I'd have just quit drinking on Tuesday, I wouldn't have had any trouble. So this time I'm going to stop on Tuesday, but we failed to designate which Tuesday. The insanity that will allow us to say to ourselves as we drive down the street, I'm just going to duck in here to Joe's and get one double. And then I'm going to run home and eat a great big steak about that big, practically raw. One drink won't hurt you if you eat. So I'll just sneak in here and get one double. Go home and eat. So we go into Joe's to get a double. And if we're lucky, we get home a week from Tuesday, you know. This is insanity. And again, if we're going to live without drinking, we must get rid of this insanity that allows us to rationalize ourselves back into another drunk. And it is my thorough and complete conviction that in order to get rid of this insanity, we must have help from a power greater than ourselves. Now, it's very simple to me. The reason I believe this is because I could not get sober and stay sober. Had I been able to get sober and stay sober, I wouldn't believe that we have to have help from the power greater than yourself. But since I couldn't, I did. And now, particularly, since I can see that this is a living problem, and not a bottle problem, I know that it is necessary for us to have help from a power greater than ourselves, because I am convinced that there is no answer to a living problem that does not include some sort of satisfactory personal partnership with the God that made it in the business of living. So I am one who believes that it is necessary that we get help from a power greater than ourselves. And I am one who believes that the finest formula under heaven for getting that help is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This formula to me is foolproof. I do not believe that it is possible for any man or any woman, regardless of their condition, to fulfill the conditions of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and fail to receive the help that we so sorely need from this power greater than ourselves. I believe that it is an automatic thing. There is a miracle in this program. There are certain things that I cannot do. I cannot stay sober. This I know. I beat my brains out for 10 years in hell trying to prove that I could, and I cannot. I cannot stay sober, now or any other time. If there was a problem with me and alcohol, I would lose it before I get back to California. I cannot win. I never won. But there is a miracle here. Now I can do the things that this program suggests. I can practice these 12 steps to the best of my ability in all of my daily affairs. And when I do this, that is my part of the miracle. And the other part is done for me. I no longer have to drink when I fulfill these conditions. This is the miracle of AA. What are the conditions of sobriety? And I'm one who believes that no alcoholic can have sobriety until he's willing to and does fulfill the conditions. I think as marvelous as these meetings are and as wonderful as our inspiration is that we take out of these meetings, the proof of the pudding comes in practicing these principles myself in my daily life. What are the conditions? Well, as we said, the 12 steps. But we haven't time to talk about all of them. I got to give Austin a little time before the barbecue, you know. It's not time to get it, is it? I hope not. We haven't time to talk about the entire 12 steps, so we'll just reduce them to three things. Number one, surrender. Surrender. And this surrender, like the disease, is twofold. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, a physical thing, that our lives had become unmanageable, a mental thing. So it is a twofold surrender, both mental and physical. It is a complete abandonment of self. And I would rather be able to say what it means to surrender than anything else that I might be able to say. I would give half of the rest of my life here to be able to tell one individual what it means to surrender. But it can't be done. There are no words. This is the most misunderstood word, I believe, in the English language, with the possible exception of the word love. Perhaps more sins are committed in the word love than the name of the word love than anything else in the world, but besides that, perhaps, surrender is the most misunderstood word in the language. We have always thought of surrender as being for the weak. The weak man surrenders. The weak army surrenders, you know. And this is one thing that caused us all to stay out of here so long. Because we are not built to surrender, we are taught. We are built to take what we want on our own terms. And this word surrender was not in our vocabulary. But truly, surrender is the open door to freedom of life. There is no freedom without it. to be able to surrender, to get out of her own way, to get rid of the necessity for ego satisfaction, is the very open door to freedom. Strangely enough, the only thing that leaves in surrender is the trouble. The only thing that goes out the window is the trouble. Everything else in life is multiplied 10,000 times 10,000. So it is my opinion that the red letter day, the greatest day in our lives, if we be alcoholics, from the cradle to the grave, is that day when we can and do say, I'm licked, I'm all done, I can't get out of this thing alone, I must have help. This is the great day for us. Surrender the recognition of the need for help. And that's all we need in the first place. Just the recognition of the need for help. We don't have to add even the words from a power greater than ourselves to stop. Just recognizing that a life lived by self-will cannot be satisfactory. That of ourselves we are licked, we're not worth the powder to blow us to hell. And we need help. That's number two. And number three is enough self-honesty to see ourselves as we are. And enough honesty to do something about it. To clear up the wreckage of the past. To clean up the mess within it. These are the conditions for sobriety. And again, I do not believe that anyone can fulfill them without getting the help. Why then do we have trouble? This is a very simple thing, too. I don't think there are many causes for trouble. I think probably first and foremost is our inability to surrender completely. There's an alcoholic alive that wouldn't be glad to surrender the bottle to anybody. Even to God. It's all right, take the bottle. But leave me alone in these other areas of life. You know? We want to hold out a little. We had a very good example of that out home. We got a good-looking young butcher that comes to the Beverly Hills Fag group. And this old boy tells this little story on himself. He says, you know, I came here, I still had a few things left. I still owned the butcher shop, had a little dough in the bank, but I was on the skids, and the skids were greased, and I was going pretty fast. And I figured I'd better try to salvage what I could. And so I came here, and he says, you know something, I like this program. I like you guys. And he says, I even like the God part of it for sobriety, but I didn't want him in the butcher shop. Then he holds up his thumbs and he says, gold. He says, I figured if I wanted to weigh my thumb, that was my business, had nothing to do with sobriety. And so, in effect, I said, all right, God, you help me with my sobriety, but just stay out of the shop, I'll let you know. And he says, you know something? It didn't work. But he says, now I got me a partner in the meat business, too. And everything's just going fine. Our inability to surrender completely. Number two, our impatience. We are the most impatient lot of people on the face of the earth. If we had all the alcoholics in the world in Amarillo this morning, we'd have 90% of the impatience of the human race. We are people who always want things to happen yesterday, you know? We'd go down to Joe and get that double and drop it, and before it got past here, we'd look the old boy right straight in the eye and say, what's the matter with you, Joe? Are you watering this stuff now? I can't feel it. And it hasn't got down past you, it hasn't started yet. Impatience causes a lot of trouble. We think that because we came here in a temporary state of surrender and got sober, that everything in life should straighten out right now. We think that on us this looks so good. You know, the little woman could call and say, oh, Chuck, come on home. I hear your soap. Yeah. Right now. And we forget that, for instance, in my case, I was willing to walk downstairs for 25 years one day at a time. Just kept walking right on down till I ran out of bottom. And we forget that we gotta go from where we are to where we're going. And we gotta do that one day at a time, one step at a time. Impatience causes a lot of trouble. And lastly, and I think the greatest trouble that we have, we're all confused about getting this help from this power greater than ourselves. Now this is what I want to talk about, and I'm running out of time. And this is what I came down here for, just to talk about this. You know, we read in the book where it says that we're like people who've lost their legs. We never grow new ones. We read that if a good philosophy had been able to do it for us, we'd have had it done because we're all philosophers. You know, we all know all the answers for everybody else but ourselves. The book says we all stopped and looked at ourselves and decided to do better because we weren't doing a very good job. But, says the book, we lack the power. We lack the power, and if we lacked the power, it was obvious we had to find one. And it was just as obvious that it had to be a power greater than ourselves. We read a little bit further, and it tells us that under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first slug, the drink we must not take. And that is help from a power greater than ourselves. And then we get to the third step, and it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. And we say, don't understand it. I don't understand him. I gotta have me another book. I gotta understand the infinite. And so we make a project out of it, and we get us another book, and we read, and we run, and we nip, and read, and run. And we forget that the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the step. And it don't say a thing about another book. Not a word. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the step. Ah, if we could just forget about trying to understand the infinite. How in the world could I understand the infinite when I couldn't even tie my own shoes? Thank God we don't have to understand. Thank God we just do these simple things. And we don't even have to find him because he finds us. The confusion of this thing causes lots of us trouble. And how does it happen and what is the spiritual life? Insofar as it's given me to perceive, there is nothing in the world to the spiritual life except that we find a good state of being, a good life, good livingness, coupled with a feeling of belonging, a feeling of kinship. Kinship first to a bunch of drunks that don't have to drink anymore. And finally, kinship to the human race, which we have never known. And eventually kinship to God, the Father of life. And all of this comes about so beautifully and so easily and so naturally if we apply ourselves to doing our part, to the practice of these principles in all of our affairs, to the surrender and the continued surrender. It comes about just like unwinding a ball of twine. And it can't keep from coming about. And I'll tell you how it happened with me, and sit down. First, I'll tell you that I am one of the most fortunate amongst men, because I didn't come to this program expecting to receive a lot. I had never even been told about the program. And so I came for just one thing, sobriety. That's all I ever hoped to find in Alcoholics Anonymous. It happened in this way with me. I had been drunk since the Friday before Christmas, the middle of January. And I had been awful drunk. And I had just been lying in bed day after day after day, drinking the clock around 24 hours a day. And I had nothing in me but liquor. And I was full of that. But about the middle of January, I woke up one morning with a completely and totally clear head. Clearer, perhaps, than it has ever been before or since. Now, I've had doctors and priests and preachers tell me that sometimes when a man is dying, he is given the ability to see himself as he is. And if he makes the right decision, he comes back. And if he makes the wrong one, he goes on over the border. I don't know whether this be true or not. I don't care. I know what happened to me. And so it was that I woke up with a clear head and I looked at me for the first time in my lifetime without an excuse. I looked at me and I saw me, and it was a pretty awful thing to see. And I knew for the first time in my life why my good wife, after 20 years, had sought counsel to get rid of me. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew that it wasn't her fault, it was mine. And I knew why our kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And were just waiting for me to be legally restrained. And I knew why, and it wasn't their fault, it was mine. And I knew why my boss had let it be known that if I ever showed up down there again, he'd throw me bodily through the window. And the window don't open. And I knew why, and it wasn't his fault, it was mine. And I saw that morning that everything that I held dear in life was gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became important to me to be sober. And for only one reason, I didn't want to die with the rest. Now, I knew I was going to die very shortly anyhow, and I didn't care. But such time as I had left, I must be sober, because I wanted to rub out what I could of that rest. And just before the curtain came down, I remembered that I'd read Jack Alexander's article in Post in 41. And I said to myself, the last thing, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the curtain came down and I had to die for a long time. I had to sit in that chair of mine for days waiting for my mind to come back, and it wouldn't come, and I knew this time the cord was broken. I was never going to get it back. But after a while, I started to clear up. And I started to try to find this fellowship. Now, I had no idea that it would be in the phone book. It never occurred to me that they'd have a number in the phone book. So my wife and I started calling people that we knew, asking them if they knew anybody that was in this fellowship. And we eventually got a phone number, and it was a picture guy. And I called this fellow, and he was working nights, and he couldn't take me, and I talked with him several times. And he was still working. And finally I said to him, Kent, where can I go? For God's sake, I'm panicky. Where can I go? And he told me. And it was on a Sunday night, just like this. And the meeting was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And I put on my overcoat. It was in January, and I pulled a collar up around my head and my hat over my face. And I went out alone to find this meeting. Now, if there's a word in the English language I understand, it's the word alone. The nearest thing I'll ever come to know of the definition of the absolute is the absolute and unconditioned aloneness of an alcoholic who's run out of time. And so I was that I walked into the door of this meeting, and they hadn't started yet. And there were a lot of nice-looking people, and they were dressed well. And they didn't look like me, and they didn't feel like me. And I said to them, to myself, this isn't the night. They've given me the wrong dope. These are the veterans and their wives having a party. These can't be the drunks. And I was just about ready to take off when a guy came up to me. And he said, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." Well, he says, "What were you looking for?" And I said, "Mister, I was looking for Brian." And he lit up like a church, and he says, "Take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place." Ah, I shall never forget this if I live to be 1,000. "Take off your hat and coat, you're in the right place." And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, a stranger. And there was something happened deep down in the pit of my stomach that says, maybe you belong here. I didn't belong any place. I wasn't even welcome in jail, let alone my own home. Maybe I belong here. And so it was that before I left that meeting, I had decided I wanted what you had and was willing to go to any length to get it. But I was afraid, oh, how afraid I was, because I didn't think I had enough left to get it. But I wanted it more than life, and I was back in a meeting every night for 6 months. Every night of the week I'm in a meeting. And as I come back, this feeling of belonging grows and grows and grows. Pretty soon I said to myself, sure enough, I belong here. These are my people. And I'm there. 6 months goes by and I wake up to the fact that I'm sober. There's a great awakening. And that's 10 years and a half ago. And everything that's happened in my life in the last 10 and a half years has just happened. It just happened. And we look back to see why. So, the first great thing was the awakening. And then I woke up to the fact that something else was happening. The good life had started. I was sleeping. Now maybe you think that sleeping is physical, but I don't. Sleeping is the good life, to be able to lie down and go to bed and lie down in bed and go to sleep without any agencies to put you to sleep at all. Why, this is a terrific thing. This is wonderful. It's the good life. How often have I laid on that bed and I'm unglued from top to bottom? And I have to sleep and there's no sleep. And I yell out, "God, please, please, 20 minutes, let me sleep 20 minutes. And there's no sleep. And here I am sleeping like a baby. And that's good. And another thing's happening. I'm eating. Now maybe you think that's physical, but I don't. Ah, to be able to wake up in the morning and smell bacon and eggs cooking and start drooling instead of, this is a terrific thing. It's so wonderful to me that even yet, I can't sit down to a meal without thinking that this is just about as spiritual a thing as the taking of the Blessed Sacrament. Why, it's a wonderful thing to eat. To eat breakfast. Whoever had eaten breakfast. Whoever had eaten dinner. Maybe a little bowl of chili once in a while. It's a wonderful thing. The good life. And then another thing is happening as time goes on. I'm becoming aware of the things that are going on around me. Ah, this is wonderful. To be aware of where we were last night, what we did, what day it is, what month it is. This is the good life. It's a terrific thing. And this is so wonderful to me that even now, after for nearly 11 years, I can sit in that same chair in the living room. Look out through the living room and through the patio and cry like a baby. Because I can see it. 10 long years I sat in that chair when I didn't know what the living room looked like, or the patio, or my wife, or the children. To be aware of the things that are going on around me. And then finally, after a couple of years, I reckon it was, I heard you monkeys say the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father." I've been saying it with you since the second night, perhaps. But I never heard it. And on this occasion, I heard it. And if there's anything more beautiful than a bunch of ex-drunks saying "Our Father," I don't know what it is. And again, something happened in the pit of my stomach. And it says, maybe, maybe this too is true. And I started playing with these words, our Father. And I wouldn't let them go. And I milked them dry from every angle that I could think of. And it wasn't long until my 11-step read sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, my Father, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. And playing with these words and bringing them down to home base. Bringing them right down to where I could understand them because of the things that were happening in my own home. My own kids had come back. And my big boy, 6'3½", and on my 3rd birthday, he had brought me a little present. And he put on the card, "All I ever hope to do or to be is to be like my dad." And I'd had to go back in the bedroom and bawl for a couple of hours because he wouldn't come home 3 years before. And I saw what a wonderful relationship this father-son thing was. And then I thought about my own father and mother and how close the relationship was with them as a kid. And then I tried to expand it into our Father. And one night I remembered that the young carpenter, when they had asked him, "Master, teach us to pray," he hadn't said, "Well, boys, if you get the right colored rug and look in the right direction and say the right things, my Father and I might help you." They said, "Master, teach us to pray." And he had said, "After this manner pray ye, our Father." And it hit me like a ton of bricks that I, hopeless, helpless, drunk, could say with a young carpenter from Galilee, "Our Father." Ah, it's terrific. It's a terrific thing. The feeling of belonging, of kinship. The feeling that can't keep from coming if we apply ourselves to these principles one day at a time. If we pray for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out and listen to what He has to tell us. These things can't help from happening, and now, because of the lateness of the hour, I'll just tell you this. This now has become the closest relationship in my life. Closer than any other. Closer than wife, closer than children. The very closest relation in my life, our Father. And the only concern I've had, and the only disconcerting experience that has been mine in the last 10 years, has been when I've allowed something to get between me and this Father of us, this broken man, the God of the broken. Was only concerned with finding the bride. Gave my attention and interest and love to this program because you told me, here are the steps we took, we're sober. And I had to be sober. And I did them for sobriety. And like you, woke up at long last to the fact that the answer to the disease of alcoholism and the answer to the riddle of life itself is one and the same answer. Nothing in the world but a personally satisfactory, individually satisfactory, conscious partnership with God, as I understand Him, as you understand Him, in the business of living. And if I should sum up my entire philosophy in one line, it would just simply be this. I feel just like a little old knot-headed kid, hanging on to the old man's hand, walking down the corridors of life, thinking it not strange to ask for and to receive guidance in everything I do. And thinking it not strange almost with every breath I draw to say, Father, I thank Thee. Thank you very much.